Alright, tonight we're on Tehillim Perek Pei Hei, and the title of tonight is The Picture on the Gate. This particular kapitel is again written by the B'nai Korach. And just to review, the sons of Korach, when the earth opened up to swallow Korach and his followers, his sons did teshuva and they regretted having followed their father. And because of that, they were able to be caught on a ledge partway down into this pit, and they watched everybody else fall to their deaths. And while they were there, they wrote a number of kapitelach, and they put them on scrolls, and they handed them down from generation to generation until they were in David HaMelech's hands. And because of the fact that they had done teshuva, and they were on this ledge, Hashem gave them a gift of being able to see the future of Klal Yisrael. And they used that inspiration to and their teshuva to write the kapitelach that we attribute to the B'nai Korach. David HaMelech put them into Tehillim, and thus we have them here. This particular kapitel, Pei Hei, is written about the return to Eretz Yisrael to build the second base of Mikdash when the people returned from Bavel after the end of the first exile, to build the second base of Mikdash. Now, if we remember, it happens to be also Megillah's Esther time, which is very convenient, because if you recall, it really didn't go quite as smooth as that sentence implied. First they went, and they started building, but then the Persian kings withdrew permission for them to build, because other people who were in Eretz Yisrael complained that this was really part of a revolution and the Jews were going to revolt, and the Persian emperors, paranoid and always afraid of their provinces rebelling, withdrew permission. And of course, Chazal tell us that when the trial was held to determine whether or not this building of the Beis HaMikdash was a rebellious act, the prosecuting attorneys, if you will, who presented the case to the emperor of Persia was none other than our friend Haman. And at that point, the building of the Beis HaMikdash was stopped, and a lot of people actually went back to Bavel. And that contributed to the fact that at the time of the Purim incident, the Jews were in a very despondent state. They saw no real sign of Hashem's presence in Bavel. And like they had when they were in Eretz Yisrael, and they had the Beis HaMikdash, and there were miracles. And here they were off on their own, so to speak. They'd started building the second base of Mikdash and been kicked out. And all of that contributed to the mood that the Jews found themselves on in Shushan, which is a different shir. But nonetheless, it didn't happen that they just went up one day. That it came about sort of in stages. And then finally, the Persian king, the child of Esther, gave permission for the Jews to go back and rebuild the base of Mikdash.
How is Bavel related to Persia? Was it a
yes, Persia captured Bavel, and it became Bavel ceased to exist. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, when they left, you're right, when they first went into the exile, it was with Nebuchadnezzar, what we call a Babylonian king. And then all of a sudden we have Persian kings. So Persia captured Babylonia, right, and conquered it, and there's no more independent Babylonia. It's done.
Is it part of the same on the same land though?
Or yes. Nobody moved.
Oh, okay.
Nobody moved physically. We just changed who's in charge. Mm-hmm. Right. And the Persian emperors, of course, ran things very differently. The Babylonian empires were very strict tyrants, and the Persians believed in every province being able to do as they wished, and sort of a confederation of states. And that everybody would be loyal and pay taxes to the central Persian government, but that everybody could do what they want. You see in the Megillah that every province had their own language and their own customs, and they did not force them to all act Persian. That, however, contributed to the fact that the emperors were always paranoid about losing their kingdom, because there were people doing who knows what. There were 127 provinces with 127 languages, customs, etc. And it was hard to keep a tight rein on that kind of confederacy. And in the Megillah, we see Ahasuerus, of course, is very paranoid about there being revolution. right? That's somebody revolting. And it's because they have this confederacy, which when it worked very well, when the provinces were loyal to Persia. However, it was not that difficult to imagine that there's no built-in loyalty. They're not really Persians. They're just provinces that happen to be ruled by Persia. So if they decide to have a revolution, it's not really so surprising because they're not really Persians. They're not really loyal to Persia. If someone else were to conquer Persia, it's no skin off there. They'll pay taxes to someone else. Right? So this Persian Confederacy took over from Babylonia, but it's the same physical place. Right? Same physical place. And in fact, Iranians today consider themselves Persians, right? Because they're descended from Persians, right? Who took over that area. And we'll see that shortly the Greeks will take over from the Persians. But nobody moves. So finally, the Esther son gave the permission for the Jews to return to Eretz Yisrael and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. And in fact, the second Beis HaMikdash had a picture of Shushan on the eastern gate. Now that sounds a little unusual. Of all the things you could put a picture on, I don't remember it saying anywhere in the Torah you should build the base of Mikdash and put a picture of Shushan on it. But the Jews were grateful to the Persian empire for letting them return and build the base of Mikdash. So the entire time the second base of Mikdash existed, the eastern gate had a picture of Shushan on it. Now we're also going to mention a little bit about the land of Eretz Yisrael in this particular capitol. And rain and fertility in the land. A good rain that makes the land fertile in Eretz Yisrael is considered a sign of Hashem's favor. That the more abundant the rain and the more fertile the land, the more Hashem is favoring the land. After the destruction of the first base of Mikdash, Chazal tell us that for 52 years, nothing grew. There were no animals. There were no birds. Even there were no fish. When they say Eretz Yisrael was desolate, they don't just mean that there wasn't a lot of stuff happening. Even the fish, it says, went into Golus. There were no fish, no animals. Not a single bird flew through Eretz Yisrael for 52 years. The land was so desolate. Hashem's wrath literally destroyed the land. For 52 years, it lie like that with absolutely no sign of life, animal life, bird life, fish life. Nothing would grow. For 52 years, it was desolate. So there's always a strong connection between the fertility and success of Eretz Yisrael and how happy Hashem is with us. Eretz Yisrael is our special promised land. It's supposed to feed us and take care of us. If it doesn't do that, it's because of something that we're doing. So with that, let's jump into the capitol. In verse 1, Pasuk Aleph, Zlamanatzeach Livnei Korach Mizmor. This is for the conductor, a song by the sons of Korach. In the next verse, it says, Ratzisa Hashem Artzecha, Shavta Shvis Yaakov. Oh, Hashem, you have appeased your land. You have returned the captivity of Yaakov. Now, appeased your land, I would say favored your land would probably be a better translation than appeased, with all due respect to the translator here. And most of the Mephoshim say this is talking about coming back from Babel. You've returned the captivity of Yaakov. Now, why doesn't it say you've returned the captivity of Yisroel? Usually we're referred to as Yisroel. Here we're referred to as Yaakov, which is less of a... Yisroel is a higher level. Usually when Hashem's happy with us, we get called Yisroel. Yaakov became Yisroel, and here we're just sort of still Yaakov. So the Mephoshim say, because even though we went back to Eretz Yisroel, we really weren't independent. We were under the rule of Persia. We still had to pay taxes to Persia. And for 34 years after the start of the second base of Mikdash, we were still under Persian rule. And then the Greeks came and captured Persia. And we were under Greek rule, which will lead us eventually to Hanukkah. So even though we came back and we had our base of Mikdash, we weren't really fully independent as a nation. Now, the Persians basically let us do what we want, but we had no political independence. So we were returned as Yaakov. We weren't returned to the heights of glory that we had before. We were returned, but not quite the same. We were under foreign rule, and we would be under foreign rule until all the way until the Maccabees and Hanukkah, which would be much later. Now, the exile in Bavel was 70 years. And Chazal tell us that during the first base of Mikdash, there were 70 Shemitahs, 70 Shemitah years that the people did not keep properly. And that the reason that the Gullus was 70 years was because of those 70 Shemitahs. Right? It says in Vayikra that if you do not care for the land, it has all the consequences that will happen. Well, every time there was a Shemitah year, 70 times, we did not properly implement the Shemitah year, and therefore we had to spend 70 years. And so he's saying, you favored your land over your people. You sent your people into Gullus for what they did to the land. So you favored your land over your people. And you've returned us, but you've only returned us as Yaakov. You favored your land over us by sending us to Gullus. What did we do? We desecrated the land. Well, who do you like more, the land or us? It says here, you know what? The land. It says in the Chumash, you have to take care of the land I give you. And we didn't. So we had to spend 70 years in Gullus. And when we returned as Yaakov. The second base of Mikdash, we're probably used to thinking of it much later in time, towards the end of the period of the second base of Mikdash, after Hurdas, Herod, had rebuilt it up into a glorious structure. The original second base of Mikdash, the Chazal tell us that there are people who were old enough to remember, it would be a pretty elderly person who could remember the first base of Mikdash. They've been in Gullah 70 years, so there easily could be people that remembered the first base of Mikdash. And when they saw the base of Mikdash, and you could not hear the instruments of the Kohanim, when they were playing the dedication of the base of Mikdash, you could hear the Levim singing, but you couldn't hear the instruments of the Kohanim over the crying of the old people. Because this is a base of Mikdash. Compared to the first base of Mikdash, it was much smaller. It didn't have any of the, it was built on a budget. And it didn't have any of the majesty that the elderly people associated with their remembrance of the first base of Mikdash. To the people who hadn't seen the first base of Mikdash, this was an amazing thing. But everything is relative. Right, so the second base of Mikdash did not start off as, you know, when the base of Mikdash was eventually destroyed, it was a magnificent structure, but it didn't start off that way. Right, it started off as a very simple structure. So Hashem chose the land over us and returned us as Yaakov. Then in verse 3 it says, Nasasa avon amecha, you've forgiven the sins of your people, kisisa kol chatasam sala, and you've concealed all their sin forever. So Hashem forgave us. He let us come back and he forgave us for everything that we did during the first base of Mikdash. And it says you've concealed all of their sin, meaning that, you know what, we still sinned. But Hashem is looking the other way. You know, like you give the kid a patch for what they did. The kid still did it. But now we're all going to pretend like it never happened. You did it, you got patched, and now we're all just going to act like nothing ever happened. Right? So that's what he's saying Hashem's attitude is. You did this bad thing, you got your patch, now I'm concealing it, we're just going to go on like nothing ever happened. It's a softer kol of rasecha. You have taken in all of your anger, all of your wrath, and you've retreated from the fierceness of your anger. So if we recall how angry, I mean, remember your kinus on Tisha B'Av and how awful the destruction was in the base of Mikdash and how very angry Hashem was and the destruction of people and the destruction of the base of Mikdash and the destruction of his land, right? He's put all that aside. You've taken in all your wrath, you've retreated from your anger, right? And you brought us back and we're starting like nothing ever happened. Shuvenu elokei yishenu v'hafer kasacha imanu. So return us, Hashem of our salvation, and revoke your anger against us. So they're saying, just like you did that after our first exile and we went back and built the second base of Mikdash, now that we're in our extended gullus, return us again. You were willing to let bygones be bygones once. Do it again. Olam tenaf banu, are you going to be mad at us forever? Timshuch achul ador vador, are you going to extend your anger generation after generation? What's troubling the Bnei Karach is they see that there's no predefined time limit to the gullus. The first gullus, the Navi says, is going to be 70 years. We had the whole issue with how exactly they calculated the 70 years, which event started the 70 years, but it was clear that it was 70 years. And that's it. Not 71, not 72, and maybe if you're in a bad mood, maybe 75. 70, period. But here there's no defined time. It's a much more difficult thing when you know that you don't know when the end is. You send the kid to his room as a punishment and say, you stay in your room until supper time at 6 o'clock. Okay, so the kid's like 2 hours, 1 hour, 58 minutes, right, et cetera, et cetera. Say, so you're going to your room, you're grounded until I say otherwise. You can't take that. Until I say otherwise, 5 minutes later, they're asking you, is it over yet? When is it over yet? 5 minutes of punishment? Right? But they can't take the fact that I don't know when it's going to be over. If you said you're grounded for 62 years, okay, fine. They start counting the 62 years. But you can't, if you say you're grounded until I say otherwise, which could be an hour, they can't take that not knowing. It's like, you're going to be mad at us forever? Generation after generation? God. All right? And the next passage is, Halo ata tashuv techeinu? Are you going to return and revive us? And your people will rejoice with you? You know what? Eventually, you're going to do this. Why not now? Like the kid says, listen, you're going to let me have a driver's license when I'm 18. So I'm 17. Why not now? It's going to happen eventually. So the argument is, listen, eventually you're going to come and get us, and we're going back there to Israel, and we're going to rebuild the base of Mikdash. What's wrong with now? Now would be a good time. How long are you going to wait? Are you going to be mad at us forever? Tell me the kid doesn't say that. How long are you going to be mad at me for? I've actually had my kids say, listen, how long are you going to be mad about this? Give me a time. All right? You know, and you're fuming, and what do you mean, how long am I going to be mad? Well, listen, you know, I did this and this, and the kid's like, how long are you going to be mad? It's like, eventually, Hashem, you're going to be unmad, and you're going to bring us back. How long is it going to last? Right? Why not do it now? There's a famous saying that is attributed to the Kotzker Rebbe. And he said, Hashem, you might as well bring us back now. We're really not getting that much better. Now, I don't know exactly what the Kotzker Rebbe meant by that. And the point is that what he's saying here is that how long are you going to be mad with us already? Generation after generation, bring us back and we'll rejoice with you. Let's come home already. In verse 8, then he says, Aharenu Hashem Chazdecha, show us your kindness, Vishecha Titan Lanu, and your salvation give to us. I say, give us your chesed. We would really like to earn our own way. We would like that Hashem is going to take us back to Eretz Yisrael and rebuild the base of Mikdash and send us Mashiach because we earned it. People like to earn their own reward. You feel much better about something if you know you earned it rather than it was given to you. Many times people will not take tzedakah when they need it. Why? Because they don't feel they didn't earn it. They don't want anything for free. They earn it. So one of the highest form of tzedakah is what? To get a person a job. So why is that? Why not let them lay home and send them food? Because a person feels better if they think they earn their own reward. Right? So we would like to earn it, but you know what, Hashem? We'll take it chesed. If we didn't earn it, take us back and build the base of Mikdash just out of chesed. We're willing to take your tzedakah. We're willing to say, okay, we didn't earn it, but we'd like it anyway. And he goes on to say, Ishma amay yedaber akel Hashem, ki yedaber shalom al amo ve'al chasidav ve'al yeshuva lechisla. I'll hear what Hashem speaks when he speaks peace to his people and to his tzaddikim, and they will not return to their folly. That's a lot of different little things in here. When he speaks to his people, when he hears, so let's start with here in the beginning. I will hear when Hashem speaks.
Who's the I?
We Jewish people. How many commandments did we hear at Har Sinai directly from Hashem? Two. And then we told Moshe Rabbeinu, we can't take this. We're not up to this. You tell us the rest. That was not a good thing. Chazal tell us that when we were hearing the commandments directly from Hashem, there was no Yetzer Hara. We were perfectly pure beings. Once we started asking that we wanted to hear it through Moshe Rabbeinu, the Yetzer Hara came back. We didn't believe that we could live up to that ideal. We didn't believe that we could really continue to hear these commandments from Hashem. We didn't believe we could accomplish that. Really, we could have. But we didn't believe that we could. So he's saying, you know what? I'm going to listen from now on. Next time, I'm going to see what I can really achieve, and I'm going to listen when Hashem speaks. I'm not going to think that I can't do it. And he says, you're going to speak to who? Your righteous nation? He's talking about your pious people. He's talking about something that Chazal say, that when we go back to Eretz Yisrael, the righteous people from all of the different nations will go with us. But the Chasidei Umas HaOlam, the people from each different nation that are righteous and that have served Hashem, will go with us. And they will not return to their folly. Now what happened when we came back from Bavel? We rebuilt the second base of Mikdash, and we lived as perfect tzaddikim from then on. No. Wrong. Sometimes we were tzaddikim, but sometimes we didn't. Sometimes we fell and we didn't do so well. Other times we did. So saying, you know what? I understand, Hashem, why you might be a little reluctant to bring us back. You brought us back once before, and we stumbled. But this time we're not going to stumble. We're going to listen to you. We're going to hear every word from you. We're going to go with our Chasidei Umas HaOlam, and we're not going to stumble. We're going to stay on the right path. Ach korov l'reiv yisho. His salvation is near those who fear him. Lishko kavod ba'artzeinu. That his glory will dwell in our land. Now his glory will dwell in our land. In the second base of Mikdash, we didn't have everything. It wasn't just that the structure wasn't as beautiful. We didn't have everything from Hashem that we had in the first base of Mikdash. Right? We didn't have the Aron, the base of Mikdash. We didn't have the fire coming down every day from Shemayim onto the Mizbeach. We didn't have Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh. We didn't have the Urim V'Tumim. You know, it says in the Nach that the king would go and ask Hashem what to do. What does that mean? It means he went to the Urim V'Tumim and he asked what to do, and the Urim V'Tumim answered him. There's no Urim V'Tumim in the second base of Mikdash. There's no Nevuah. So we would like to come back, and that the glory will dwell in our land. We want all the things back. We want Nevuah, and we want all the Nisim back, and we want the Aron back. We want the Keruvim back. We want all the things back that we didn't have in the second base of Mikdash. So how Chesed ve'emes nifgashu, kindness, Chesed and Emes have met, Tzedek v'Shalom nashaku, and Tzedek and Shalom have kissed. Sort of a cryptic verse, but the Meforshim say what it means is that Chesed ve'emes, when we do emes, Hashem will give us the chesed that we want. Klal Yisrael is supposed to be a light unto the nations. We're supposed to represent emes in the world. People are supposed to look and say, Jewish people, they really have it together. They really serve Hashem. These are righteous, emistic people. When we do that, Hashem will be more than happy to give us our chesed. We can earn our chesed with emes, by acting in the proper way and representing what it means to serve Hashem to the rest of the nations, we can actually earn our own chesed, rather than having to wait for Hashem to give us a chesed. And when it says that Tzedek and Shalom kissed, it means that you can't have one without the other. They're so intertwined. If you don't have Shalom, if you don't have peace, you can't have tzedek, you can't have justice. There's no way in a war-torn, strife-filled world to really have tzedek, to really have justice. They're so necessary, they're so intertwined, that they say they've kissed. That's a metaphor for the fact that they're unbreakable, unbreakably bound together. Emes me'aretz titzmach, truth will sprout out from the earth, but tzedek mishamayim nishkaf, and righteousness will look down from heaven. So down from heaven usually refers to the rains, that the land is going to be restored. even though right now in Eretz Yisrael there's a lot of fertile areas, etc. If you've ever and looked into agriculture in Eretz Yisrael, it's tough going. It is really tough going. You can get produce from the land, but Chazal tell us that in the future, the rains that'll come down will not just be regular rains; will be rains from Shemayim. It says, the rains will come down from Shemayim, and it will produce food in abundance that will both nourish the body and the soul, and that it'll be a whole different kind of situation. The rain will not only come as needed, but it'll be special rain from Shemayim. Like it says in the Nas Pasuk, Gam Hashem Yitein HaTov, Hashem will give us good, Ve'artzeinu Titein Yevul, and our land will give its produce. That's certainly not the situation today. No matter how much you dig and plant and irrigate, it's still very tough going. But once we have our chesed, then the rain comes from Shemayim and everything will be fine. Tzedek Lefon of Yahalech, righteousness will go before him, Ve'yasem V'derech Ba'amav, and he will place it in the way of his steps. 14 Pesukim saying, listen, if you represent Emes, Hashem will not just take care of you, he'll take care of the land as well. You want to earn? You want to earn your chesed? If we can't earn our chesed, we'd like to have it as a chesed. But we need the whole package. We need the land. We need all the nisim from the Beis HaMikdash. We need the Aron back. How long, Hashem, are you going to be angry with us and prevent us from happening? You know, when a father's angry with his children, and then he has to go to shul on Yontif, and he wants to be dancing with his children, but he just had to punish them. We don't want that kind of situation. What is Peihei getting at here? Seems sort of straightforward. He's saying, listen, you be good guys, Jewish people, and this is what you're going to get back. There's a... Thinking about Reuben's book, he has a nice mashal. He says, you know, in your own house, everything is designed to make sure your kids don't get into too much trouble. They don't break things. They don't get into, you know, it's childproof. You childproof your house. Then you go over to Bubby and Zadie's house. Bubby and Zadie's house is like a disaster waiting to happen, right? Because Bubby and Zadie's tend to forget how much damage little kids can do. So they pull this out, they pull that out, and okay, fine, and Bubby and Zadie are going along with it. Then something big happens, and some massive thing is broken. Bubby's special vase, Zadie's whatever, right? And what does the mother say? Go tell Zadie you're sorry. All right, the kid doesn't want to do it. I don't know if he goes to Zadie, sorry. So he goes and tells Zadie he's sorry, and what does Zadie say? Okay, fine. And the next week, they're back at Bubby and Zadie's house again. Now, how does the kid keep coming back and telling Zadie he's sorry? The kid knows, last week I broke everything these people own. I told them I was sorry. They forgave me. Let's go back again next week. If you would think that a kid's reaction would be, I don't want to go back there. Every time I break something, I have to apologize. It's a whole big maisa. I don't want to do that. If you tell me I can go there and never have to say or sorry, maybe. But I don't want to go and I'm going to break something. I'm just a kid. I know, and I like to get into stuff. But the kid knows that Zadie will always forgive him because Zadie and Bubby love him. And Zadie and Bubby are his special Zadie and Bubby. And basically, anything he does accidentally, they're going to forgive him for. So he can go back and he can say, I'm sorry. And he doesn't feel bad about coming the next week. Because he knows that Zadie loves him. On Yom Kippur, when we do teshuva, there's a very common problem. And the problem is that people don't really believe that they can do Teshuva and be forgiven for so many things. You come to Yom Kippur, person comes to Yom Kippur, and many times you start thinking, you start going through the video, you see all the different things, and you realize, wow, I guess there were a lot of brachas I made that I didn't have great kavanah on, and maybe I wasn't so respectful to my mother last week, and you start thinking about it, and there's a tendency to think, this is just overwhelming, to be overwhelmed by the amount of things that you maybe didn't do perfectly. That you're asking Hashem to forgive you for all these different things out of his chesed. Like the little kid is coming back every week to Zadie. So the little kid comes back every week. Right? You have to come on Yom Kippur. How is it possible? You think you get discouraged. It's very easy for people to get discouraged on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is supposed to be a great, wonderful day. You could be forgiven for all these things that you did wrong. Why be discouraged? Because it seems so overwhelming. Seems like there's so many things. Hashem's going to just wipe out this much stuff? Okay, maybe a few things I see, you know, you could erase a little bit, but how could he possibly forgive these things? The lesson in this capital is that there really is no end. Just like the little kid can keep coming back to Zaidi all the time because he knows there's no end to what Zaidi would do for him, there's no end to Hashem's love and acceptance. There is absolutely no limit and no end. How long are you going to be mad with us, Hashem? There's no limit to your love and acceptance. We come every Yom Kippur overwhelmed, and you wipe the whole thing out. Just like going to Bubby and Zadie's house and breaking Bubby's favorite, whatever, forget it. Come back next week. So how long, Hashem, are you going to keep us at arm's length when you constantly, on a day-to-day basis, show us there's no end to your love and acceptance? How is it possible to come on Yom Kippur with so many things and Hashem just wipes them out? Even better, then you come back next year. Because what do you tell Yom Kippur? I'm not going to do this anymore. So you would think next Yom Kippur you come back, you have nothing to say. Right? I mean, last year I told you, Hashem, I wasn't going to do this anymore. So you know what? I'm really busy. I don't need Yom Kippur anymore. Okay, fine. One thing I did by accident. All right. Well, we'll let that go. Right, but what do I really need Yom Kippur for next year? I promised I wasn't going to do any of that. But for me anyway, I come back next Yom Kippur and I seem to have just as long a list as I did last Yom Kippur. Right? So how can that be? I promised Hashem, you would think Hashem would say, listen, buddy, you told me last year you weren't going to do that anymore. You told me you were going to be the best son ever. You told me you were never going to do this. You told me you were never going to do that. Right? And now you're here a year later. You got the same list. What's wrong with you? So you would think that the Shab would say, listen, enough. Tough love, buddy, enough for you. But Hashem is more like the Zaidi above him. So yeah, okay. You gave it your best shot, right? Do you really mean it? Okay, fine. We'll let it go. And the B'nai Korach see that because they're looking out on that ledge through history and they see that we go on and on and on and Hashem always takes us back. Everything we do... We didn't keep 70 Shemitahs. The world is wrong with us. You can't read the Pesukim that say if you don't keep Shemitahs, bad things are going to happen. So bad things happen. We went into Golas. Oh, Beis HaMikdash destroyed. Right? Don't do Avodah Zarah. Don't do it X, Y, and Z. And we did it. Every time. What happens? Hashem takes us back. And Hashem is going to take us back again. So that's the B'nai Korach's question. So why wait so long? Why wait so long? You're going to take us back again. Everything we do, no matter how much we mess up, you're our Bubby and Zaid, and you take us back again. So let's not wait. Let's cut to the end, Chase. We know you're taking us back. You always take us back. Take us back now. And we want everything back. We want to come back to Bubby and Zaidi's house. Don't forget to fill up the candy dishes. Don't forget to have all my favorite toys out, right? Because you're my Bubby and Zaid, and you love me no matter what. I can come and break your house, and next week, you know what? The candy dishes are back out again. How many Bubby and Zaidi say, no, not another cookie. That'll spoil your dinner. Never happens. At least my house. So it's like, Hashem, you're going to take us back and you're going to give us everything that we want. You're going to say, all right, you messed up. I'm giving you the arm back. Okay, you know what? I'm going to give you Nevuah back. So let's do it already. Why? We didn't go back to Bubby and Zaidi's house last week. Well, let's go. We know Bubby and Zaidi are there waiting for us. They got the candy dish out. Let's go already. The reason the B'nai Korach can say, let's go already, is they know that there's no end to Hashem's love of us. There's no end. There's no way that Hashem will say, no, I'm not interested. You went too far this time. But every time, no matter what we do, Hashem takes us back. We've been learning Megillah, and at the times of the Megillah, things looked so grim for Klal Yisrael. Hashem was this close to saying, you know what, I just can't take it anymore with you people. No matter what, no matter how far we went, he always takes us back. That's, I think, the sort of general understanding of this kapitel. If I were thinking of something in mind when I was saying this kapitel, that's sort of what I would have in mind. That no matter what, Hashem is always going to take us back. So we're asking him, come on, let's do it now.
So yes. Taking vehicles, you're saying, if they asked Hashem to give us back the Nevuah and all this other stuff,
that he didn't do.
So in the second base of Mikdash, he didn't do that. Correct. Correct. That's a good question. So,
among other things, he didn't do.
Among other things, yes. So Hashem felt that at that time, we needed to learn that lesson, that he'll always take us back, but we have to be careful. Now, when you go back to Bubby and Zadie's house, they tell you, be careful, don't break anything again. It's a good question, because the way I'm explaining this, it would seem that when they came back, the second base of Mikdash, Hashem should have given them everything back. He should have given them the Aron, and he should have given them everything back. Instead, they came back in a very low-key kind of way. You know, the first base of Mikdash, you had Shlomo HaMelech and a big grand dedication and you know, huge thing, whereas in the second base of Mikdash, you didn't have that, and you didn't have all of these things like Nevuah, etc. That's a good question, and my answer is probably not as good as your question, but my answer is that when Hashem took us back, he laid down some additional rules to make sure that to help try and help us not go off the path again. In other words, he felt that if we didn't have these things, perhaps we would be more cognizant of doing the right thing and we wouldn't get into trouble again. So when we went back to Bubby and Zadie's and they didn't put out the breakable candy dish, they put out something else. So Hashem brought us back and he said, you know what, I don't want you guys to mess up again. I'm not going to give you the R and I'm not going to give you these things, and it'll show you the right way to go and it'll really help you stay on the right path. Even though we wanted it, Hashem was giving it something that was better for us to try and stay on the right path. So without the Nevuah and without the other things that we didn't have, he thought it would be easier for us to stay on the right path. Because we lost in the second base of Mikdash, we had no Yetzer Hara, for there was no Avodah Zarah. That was supposed to help us stay on the right path. Worked a little and didn't work a little, but that was supposed to help us stay on the right path.
No question. So if Hashem let B'nai Korach see some of the future, why didn't they just also see when the second galus is going to end? They kept saying, oh, well, let's just let this galus end, let the galus end. So
right, Hashem didn't show them that. Right. Hashem didn't show them when this galus is going to end. Right, or they could have just written down. And then after, so seeing, you know, all the people, there are many people throughout Jewish history that were given by Hashem Ruach HaKadosh, or the ability to see into the future, you know, David HaMelech, but none of them were given the ability, with the exception of Yaakov Avinu and Daniel, none of them were given any indication as to when the final redemption would be. And Yaakov Avinu, we know from the Chumash, he wanted to tell his kids, but Hashem wouldn't let him. And Daniel also knew. But even the B'nai Korach, when they looked out and saw the whole history, they weren't able to see that. And you know, when we talk about other people in Nach that had Ruach HaKadosh, so why didn't they just use the Ruach HaKadosh to see? That they couldn't see. Even with Ruach HaKadosh, you can only see that which Hashem wants you to see. Right? And that Kates, as they call it, the end of days, when Mashiach will come, is not something that he let them see when it would be. Why? We'll know when we know. But they didn't know the answer to that.
So I have a logistic question about these B'nai Korach who are on this ledge and they're writing down these Nevuahs and so did they live on these ledges, or then did they climb up, or did they go down?
They climbed out afterwards.
They climbed out.
Right. They climbed out afterwards. And they lived. I don't know how long they lived. We don't know much about the rest of their lives, but they climbed out. They lived. They passed the scrolls down. I don't know exactly how they climbed out, if someone helped. I don't know. We don't know exactly how they got out, but yes, but they were there for a long time while everybody was falling in, you know, into Gehenna. And eventually then they were able to get out.
So the scrolls that they were writing were what?
So the scrolls they were writing were these words right here. Right?
Where did they find the paper? On the ledge.
You know what? I don't know. Perhaps they finished the scrolls when they climbed back out. I mean, we know they created these scrolls. They wrote the Kapitaloth. They wrote the Tehillim on the ledge. Right? I don't know exactly. Perhaps when they got out, they finished writing it onto a scroll, right? And then they, you know, passed it on. They gave it to Moshe Rabbeinu, and he passed it on to everybody until David HaMelech had it. And so it could be they finished the scrolls when they got out. The actual composing, composition, if you will, occurred on the ledge. I don't know exactly when they wrote it on the scroll. It would make sense to think maybe when they got out of the ledge, they wrote it on the scroll. But the composing, the inspiration, once they got out of the ledge, they no longer had their Ruach HaKodesh. They were just, you know, Bnei Korach who had done Teshuvah, but they were people. They didn't have that gift anymore. That gift only lasted while they were on the ledge. So that what they composed on the ledge, they composed with the ability to see this, and then somehow afterwards they wrote it down on these scrolls. However the mechanics of that worked, they passed the scrolls on, but they no longer had this Ruach HaKodesh anymore. So for the rest of their lives, they didn't, you know, people didn't come to them and say, what's your Ruach HaKodesh? They got that gift while they were on the ledge as payment for doing teshuva, right? And Hashem wanted for some reason them to see what was going to happen and that their teshuva was worthwhile. I'm not sure exactly. And they composed this. So we call it they wrote it down. I mean, it could be they finished writing, like you're saying, when they got out. But all the composing of it happened while they were on the ledge, because that's when they had the vision and the Ruach HaKodesh. Any other questions?
I have one more question.
Okay.
How many years was the first Beis HaMikdash? So it was 70 years that they didn't do Shemitah well. So 70, how many years was the first Beis HaMikdash?
Right. It was the majority of time of the first Beis HaMikdash. The 70 times 7 is...
Many years.
calculated there. So it was almost the whole time of the first Beis HaMikdash.
Wow. That was almost the whole... I'm sorry.
That they didn't keep the Shemitah years properly. You know, like so many other times in Jewish history, there were was times of great heights and great disasters also. You know, really the high point was the building of the Beis HaMikdash. When Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash and completed David HaMelech's dream, things really started going downhill from there. You know, because after Shlomo, the kingdom split. And while, as we said before, there were a number of very good kings in very good periods, especially in the southern kingdom of Yehuda, it was never what it was with David and Shlomo. David and Shlomo, that was the high point, you know, the high point of Klal Yisrael. And that was when the Beis HaMikdash opened, so to speak. So up until then, let's say, they're, you know, once the Beis HaMikdash opens, now the kingdom splits. There's machlokas everywhere, all right? There's wars. And Shemitah sort of starts falling by the wayside because people don't have as much emun as they had or for whatever reason. And it starts getting progressively worse. It's a little hard to imagine that here's the Beis HaMikdash with fire coming down from Shemayim every day, yet they didn't keep Shemitah. I guess it's true that when something becomes so accustomed and so often, you stop thinking of it as a special thing. That's all I can think of, because it's hard to imagine anything. It's hard to imagine people that came through the Yam Suf then complaining to Hashem in the Midbar. It's hard to imagine... People, it's hard to imagine both sides. It's hard to imagine being in the Beis HaMikdash. It's hard to imagine, you know, the Yom parting and you walking through. But it's equally hard to imagine how then you could be complaining to Hashem a month later, you know, that you're not happy. Not happy. Remember the thing with the water? Right? And so it's hard to imagine both sides because we live in sort of a middle zone. You know, we're never as righteous as David and Shlomo. And we don't, you know, get a chance to go in the midbar and test ourselves either. We're not put to those kind of tests. It's very hard to imagine. But yeah, the whole period of the first Beis HaMikdash, Shemitah was very poorly kept.
Esther's son, did he act like a Jew when he was king? Did he live like a Jewish person? Or did he...
That is an excellent question.
Oh, that's part
of it.
Come on,
Wednesday.
I know.
It's an excellent question. To the best of my knowledge, and since I'm not 100% sure, I'll probably erase it from the tape. Everything I've read says that no, that he was a Persian king. You know, Ahasuerus was not going to put up with a son who put on tefillin. But he still had, you know, a Jewish neshaba, and so he was kindly disposed towards his fellow brethren. But as far as we know, he did not conduct himself outwardly as a Jew.
But in regular history, they never mention Esther as being his mother.
Right. Even in Jewish history, it's not mentioned that often. Esther, once the Megillah is over, Esther sort of gets pushed to the sideline, and she has to live her life out with Ahasuerus. They're horrible circumstances. I mean, the guy's just a horrible, horrible person to be married to. Forget even living with, to be married to. Right? And she, you know, she really gave her life for the Jewish people. And she doesn't always get, she gets the credit in the Megillah, but then she doesn't get credit for what she did for the rest of her life.
Probably was after she gave birth to him, they probably, you know, have the, took him away and brought him up like a prince.
Very likely.
I mean, because she was just one of his wives, right?
Right. Well, that's true, but he was she was the only one that he wrote a marriage contract with. The other wives were more like concubines. I mean, they had sort of three statuses. They had concubines, wives who he didn't have to do anything for. So sort of like a concubine, he could get rid of them if he wanted. And then the main wife with the marriage contract and the queen, et cetera, which was Esther. But yeah, I mean, it's very unlikely that she raised him. Most likely he was raised and trained in various royal procedures and with the assumption that he would be king someday. And then 34 years after he gave permission for the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt, Persia was captured by the Greeks. And we don't know what happened to him. Or to Esther, for that matter.
Had she been married to Mordecai? Did you understand what she had before?
Well, according to one opinion, she was married to Mordechai, but once she went into the palace voluntarily, so if you remember, in the middle of the Megillah, Mordechai says, you're going to have to go in, and even though the king hasn't called you. So up until that point, she only went when the king forced her to go. Once she went involuntarily to the king, she couldn't stay married to Mordechai anymore. So even according to the opinion that she was married to Mordechai, after that point, she no longer was. And so we don't know when the Greeks came. We don't know what happened to Esther. We don't know what happened to the king.
They say there's this friend of a friend say that their family in old Persia like kept the graves like holy of Esther and Mordecai, and that they were the watchers of the graves, and like the Jewish people were run out of the area, but for some reason they allowed certain people to stay and just watch over these graves that still exist now, and people are still watching.
You know, I've heard that. I don't know much about it.
This family said that they, like her family, did it. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. True. Yeah, I don't know. I've heard that.
I've heard it.
And I don't know. But I don't know any details about it. I've heard that also.
A lot of holy people in Persia that know a lot of things that we don't hear over here.
Right.
Is it Jewish?
Oh yeah, it's like
yeah.
And
that's why, you know, we don't
mix. Yeah, she said her aunt so and so would like they. She stays by this house and she's the watcher of the graves. Or
but are the graves still there? And has that been destroyed?
I don't know. In 2009, but she said her aunt would. You know, that's what her aunt did.
So we're talking 60 years ago.
Well, but if she's telling her aunt, yeah, it has to be within pretty recent times. I mean,
yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Anyway, but they said that the people, even though they hated Jews, they respected these graves
of Esther and Mordecai.
Yes.
Because they were recorded in Persian history as great people. Mm-hmm. But we don't know after the Greeks came what happened. You know, we don't really know about her life, like on a ongoing basis, other than that she was the queen.
But you don't know if he had a bris and like.
Don't know.
Probably not.
Most likely not. I mean, the custom in those days was to take away the babies and have them raised and trained to be royalty. And really, it would be more under the father's dominion because Ahasuerus would be training him in various royal things. But they don't know for sure. I find it very interesting that the Megillah closes. You know, we think the Megillah should be over halfway through when we defeat Haman. I've always thought the Megillah should go on more because I want to know what happened to Esther and to Mordecai after that. Mordecai, we pretty much know. I want to know what happened to Esther and the kids. I'd like a whole series, you know, Esther 3, Esther 4, you know, each one like 2 years in the life of Esther. But we don't have that. Apparently, either at one point it was known, obviously, at the time. But Chazal, for whatever reason, must not have thought it was essential enough to preserve, and so it doesn't seem to be written down anywhere. Any other questions? Okay, next week, Emir Kisushem, same time, same place, and next week is On the Run Again, Psalm 86. Oh,
I don't
sure.
Quite
last pasuk.
Place it on the way of the steps. What is that pilot?
Oh, it's a good question. I don't know if anybody else wants to know the answer or not. And that is, it place it on the way of the steps, meaning you can walk in your own steps and earn your own reward. And so I should have mentioned that. That he's placing it in the way of the steps, meaning you can step up to your own reward. He's giving you the opportunity. Follow the proper steps, and you'll be rewarded.